Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Montreal, Canada, and began drawing concept vehicles at age 8. He earned an executive MBA from Michigan State University and joined Chrysler in 1992 as a designer in its design office. Since 2015, he's been the head of design for Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep Ram, and specialty vehicles, as well as Fiat, Alfa Romeo, and Maserati. A modern-day Horatio Alger story? His name? Ralph Giel. And I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Crisula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Ralph Giel. Since 2015, he's been the head of design for FCA Chrysler. Ralph, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Honored to be here, Jack.
Let's start with your childhood and tell us about your childhood and your mom and your dad.
Well, I got to put it in context. I grew up in Montreal, which at the time it seemed like a faraway place from Detroit, but today it's just a skip, hop, and a jump. Pretty much was born in New York City. My parents are immigrants from Haiti, and they came to America for a better life, you know, escaping some pretty challenging situations. But we quickly moved to Montreal within a year. So I basically think of myself as a Canadian, even though I have an American passport. So my sensibilities are Canadian. So we grew up very humble, middle class, lower middle class family. And my parents were all about eyeing the future. If we can get here, you're going to do better than we did. That kind of attitude. So we were very protective of who we surrounded ourselves with, what we did with our free time. And my uncle would have this famous phrase called, keep your eye on the prize. He'd always say that to me. And to this day, I kind of echo that in my own mind. You know?
What's the biggest thing, Ralph, you learned from mom? And what's the biggest thing you learned from dad?
Be careful how you carry yourself. You know, as immigrants, there were some challenging times, you know, when people would kind of second guess what you might be about, how you projected yourself seemed very important to my father. And to this day, I'm very conscious of that. You know, I want to leave people better than I found them, whatever the situation, whether it's a janitor or an executive from another company. I really want them to know that they matter to me and there's value there. So that idea of granting everyone value even before you know them.
What were your dreams as a kid?
Pretty much what I'm doing today. I didn't know it was a job. I didn't know you can go to school and learn how to draw cars for a living and be a part of leaving a legacy of product behind. So I'm living the dream. I really, really am. I pinch myself every day when I spring out of bed to go to work. Yeah.
At 11, a letter was written to Lee Iacocca.
Yeah, it was a little bit later. I started spending my summers in Manhattan, just outside Syosset, New York, with my aunt. And she, I was sketching all the time. So my parents both worked. So in the summer, they'd ship me off to New York to spend the summers there. I would sketch and sketch, and she encouraged me to send a letter to Chrysler. I looked back, and it turned out I was actually 15, but I'd been drawing since I was about 8, 9 years old. And Chrysler took the time to answer the letter and recommended a few great design schools, which I took them up on. Yeah.
And one of them was Center of Creative Studies?
Yes.
And that's how you got to Detroit.
Exactly. Again, it was it wasn't such a straight line, to be honest with you. I got the recommendation, but I sat on it for a while. I actually went to school in Montreal and dropped out. And my brother said, what are you doing? You know, let's figure this out, you know, and encouraged me to really get in contact long before email and all that stuff. So I literally cold called the school and they told me the right procedure, and here I am. It seems like a blur, but today I enjoy a seat on their board. I'm on the board of trustees at CCS, so it's an interesting story.
We hear about Center of Creative Studies, yeah. A lot of famous alumni. Tell us, as a board member, paint us a picture of Creative Studies.
I liken it to, if anyone's familiar with the X-Men movies or the superhero movies, you go there and it's a land of incredibly talented people. There are people from all walks of life, all over the world, much more international than it gets credit for. And they all are pretty darn good. If they're pretty talented at what they do, if they're going to get to that school in the first place. So you're talking about some of the best illustrators, product designers, craftspeople, fine artists, and industrial designers, and now animation. I mean, the school has actually grown and adapted with times, and has these electronic careers where people are designing spaceships for movies and theming movies and getting into that whole space. So it's a fascinating place. I love being there, just walking the halls and being infected by the outstanding overrun of creativity that emanates from that school.
Yeah. We're talking to Ralph Giel, whose parents were Haitian immigrants, grew up in Montreal. Ralph, where did you get your love and your eye for design?
Well, it's kind of a weird deal because I grew up in what I would call the ugly 70s. And the 70s, you know, the cars went through a tough time in the 70s. They were really pretty till about 71, 72. And then a lot of strange things happened. A lot of rules came in and shrunk American cars down. And I remember as a kid walking around Montreal going, why are the cars so ugly, you know? There was a few cars like this, the Italian Ferraris and the Porsches were kind of neat, but for the most part, the average car on the road was not so good looking. So I remember thinking about that a lot and comparing, just having an eye for noticing, why does that car appeal to me? Why this one doesn't? And then Montreal is the land of Formula One. I mean, it draws a lot of enthusiasts from all over the northeast from America to Toronto, upstate New York. So they all come there in June for the Formula One race. And I used to love walking downtown and seeing all the amazing machines that would come visit. And that just got under my skin. I just couldn't stop thinking about wanting to be part of that. Yeah.
Are you also a hockey player?
No, my brother was. My parents went broke on getting him equipment, so they said no way when it was my turn.
We're talking to Ralph Giel. When we come back, we're going to ask him about how it was that he got hired by Chrysler in 1992. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula. We're talking to Ralph Giel, who joined Chrysler in 1992 as a designer in the design office. Ralph, how did it come to be?
Well, it was a bit of like a draft pick. That's the way CCS used to run it back in the day. We'd have our work up on the walls, and the auto companies would come through. Even the Asian auto companies, but GM, Ford, Chrysler, Honda, Toyota, would all walk through. And I did get a conditional offer from Ford and one from General Motors, just a discussion with General Motors, and a serious offer from Chrysler. And my mind was made up even as soon as I saw that letter from Chrysler. I just had to work there. A lot had to do with them writing to me when I was a kid. It really meant a lot to me, and to this day, I feel a sense of loyalty to them.
Have you ever met Lee Iacocca?
Yes, I did. He he famously would take tours through the studios, and I remember him walking with his entourage, chomping on a cigar, lit cigar, coming through the studios and waving at me. I shook his hand, and that's about it, but fascinating
with the
person.
Colored shirts with the white collar and the...
He was a spectacle, in a good way.
And he was the face of Chrysler.
He was
very effective, too.
Matter of fact, his commercial, he used to have that famous commercial. He says, if you could find a better car, buy it. And my aunt used to talk about that all the time. And that's why we ended up, it was his presence that made her write the letter to Chrysler, because it was the only company we could think of because of the
commercials. Paint for us a picture of Chrysler in 1992.
A very cool place. So Chrysler had just built the new building in Auburn Hills, which is second only to the Pentagon. So a beautiful complex. It was the most modern thing. It was a campus that has everything, wind tunnels to engine labs to design studios. So for me, it was amazing to be part of this resurgence. And Chrysler had shown the Viper concept car and the Portofino. They had a great slew of designs that they were showing at the Detroit Auto Show all through my time at school. So when I started there, I couldn't wait to see who are the people behind these incredible cars. And sure enough, I met the designers of the Viper and the designers of the 300 concept car at the time, and then the Intrepid. And there was some great cab forward designs coming along. So it was a very interesting time. When Chrysler had a certain bravado to it, they were really ready to take on the world. They had a new license for design, and they were really pushing the envelope on design, which really appealed to me.
Dieter Zetsche.
Yes. What a great character. I actually bumped into him now and again at auto shows around the world. Another character. So we've had many interesting CEOs. I've worked for about 7 CEOs in my career, and Dieter's one of them who's memorable and did a lot of great things. We were with Mercedes-Benz for quite a while there, you know.
Tom Lazorda grew up right across the bridge. His dad was a union worker in a Chrysler plant. Mm-hmm. That's where he come from. talk to us about Tom Lazorda.
Yeah, I spent quite a bit of time with Tom. I mean, Tom really did promote me quite a bit. He actually put me right at the top of design, but right before he retired. We had a good relationship. We would have some nice lunches together. But great guy, and he was really just starting to think about taking the company global and being much more collaborative with other partners. So a lot, very brave guy. He'd be one of those guys who would just go for it.
All right, Bigger Than Life, mm-hmm. The late, great Sergio Marchionne.
Wow. There's lessons I've learned from him in the last 10 years. I've worked very closely with Mr. Marchionne, and we're very sad, obviously, for his passing and his family. We still feel for him. He's an interesting guy, complex individual, part Canadian, part Italian, you know, so we had a little bit of stuff in common there, but he had a very humble side to him, at the same time a fearless side, and expected a lot of his people. And I've learned I thought I was humble, but I didn't know what humble meant until I really spent time with him. And also collaboration. I mean, the organization has never been flatter. And that's one thing he really drove to us is we need to collaborate. We need to all be aware of each other's struggles. And we'd have these giant committee meetings that we still do today. So that's a permanent part of who we are. But just can't thank him enough for what he did. You know, he really did save the company and took a chance on us kids. You know?
You were a member of the FCA Group Executive Council, and as such, you were in a lot of 8, 10, 12-hour meetings with the man.
Yeah, I still am. Okay. Those haven't stopped, too.
What's the single biggest thing you learned from Sergio?
Never say never and never say you can't. He really said it. We want you to think about yourself as number one in the truck segment, number one in, you know, and he predicted where Jeep would be today, and it is still one of the fastest-growing brands in the world. So, yeah, he just said don't give up, you know.
We're talking to Ralph Giel, who runs design for FCA. Ralph, how do you explain America's fascination and love affair with cars?
Well, it's the way our country's laid out. It's such an amazingly beautiful country. It begs you to go see it. It's large. It was designed for cars. I mean, really, the way the road system is. You could argue some of the cities have outgrown cars or whatever, but for the most part, the vast part of America still works. And freedom. I mean, it really is one of the amazing bastions of freedom is the ability to be able to afford a car, to buy one on an average salary, and go places and go visit your parents and all that. So I love that part of it. And the challenge is always combining everything. Things, safety, affordability, functionality, and why should you not be in love with what you own, right? So my job is to make people be smitten with their cars, not just like them.
Yeah. If you want to learn more, www.fcagroup.com. Ralph, 1981, what was your first car?
Wow, I wasn't driving quite yet then, but I loved the Volkswagen Scirocco. Was my very first car that I would admit to having. I had other few ugly cars, but that was the one I cherished.
How many do you own today?
Oh, I don't like to talk about that too much. More than I need. And my daughter made fun of me. She needed to borrow one of our cars, and I had nothing that was winter worthy, just a collection of sports cars. A few. Double digits, let's put it that way.
The Woodward Dream Cruise.
Yeah.
When you take one car out to go out there, what do you take?
The Demon. The Challenger. Yeah.
The old adage, you are what you drive, is that still true today?
Absolutely. I think there's a lot of choice out there, and people do shop what makes them feel good, and they do their homework. And you could see, I mean, we design cars for that reason. We want people to project who they are, their personality, and we offer them in crazy differences in color and types and styles, and especially with our Challengers and some of our more fun cars. I love how people configure them.
In doing research for you, one article was entitled, The American-Canadian Haitian Kid Credited with Saving Chrysler from Self-Destruction, the Chrysler 300.
Wow.
How did it come about?
Yeah. I hate to take credit for saving Chrysler, goodness gracious. It was a platform. We had this, again, this partnership with Mercedes, which gave us access to a very fine rear drive platform. And it was this love affair with grand. How far can we take the Chrysler brand? You know, really put it in as a stately but yet affordable car. So that was the assignment from my leadership at the time. And we went with a vehicle that, first of all, had to be able to wear wheels and wear, you know, celebrate its wheels and its presence and its power. It had the Hemi engine. at the time was the feature engine. So we kind of took all of that and came up with a solution that you could not ignore. You know, and I give credit to other designers. You know, Bob Hubick, who's retired years ago, actually had that. He captured that Ghia front end, that large egg crate grill, and I took it and made it more of a production car. At the time, it was just a concept type of car.
Lee Iacocca once famously said that, you know, he was very involved with the Mustang for Ford. Mm-hmm. And he said, I went home once to Pennsylvania, and I saw a little breakfast joint said, our hotcakes are selling like Mustangs. And he says, that's when I knew we had a winner.
I love that.
Ralph Giel, when did you know this Chrysler 300 was a phenomenal winner?
I think when Time Magazine called me and wanted to talk about it. So yeah, I was ended up on a double page spread. It was pretty embarrassing, and a lot of people wanted to discuss the car, and I was just doing my job. I was already on to the next project, so it was very interesting when people. It seemed to represent more than just the car. It seemed to be a movement, an Americana. You know, it was something about the vehicle that resonated. And we saw it in the clinics too. We really did see that the car was going to be a hit, and it really was. It sold like hotcakes for a long, long time.
All right, I'll ask you a question that Sergio would ask you. Ralph, why can't we do this every time?
Sometimes it's timing. Sometimes, you know, culture, it just everything just aligns perfectly. And, you know, buying power of people, the attitude of people, the newness. And we started something with a sedan that had windows that only sports cars there have. You know, so there's a lot of things that we took chances on. It converged perfectly.
We're talking to Ralph Giel, and I'm Jack Krasula. And this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Krasula. We're with Ralph Giel, who in 2005, he led the styling of the North American Car of the Year, the 2005 Chrysler 300. Ralph, let's talk about car design.
Yes, it is art. People, my mother to this day confuses me with an engineer. I am not an engineer. I'm an artist. I really do. Every car you drive today, I don't care what manufacturer makes it, starts with a sketch. Usually it's a little doodle on a napkin in designer's mind. Nowadays, the only difference is we go to digital tools. We do on tablets, so you never run out of paper, you never run out of colors, and you can transfer that image very quickly to many people. And then the car starts off as an idea. Usually you get a brief, you know, and all that stuff. But I'm always looking, personally, my team as well, we're looking for what popular culture wants, not so much what they see today. What will they want in a few years? And as we go global, what do those cultures want? So you're trying to create vehicles that underscore a movement or create a movement or actually celebrate a movement. So it's not just being a piece of metal. It's trying to give something character and find white space in a segment where no one has a solution exactly what you have. So car design is quite a challenging one. Cars are getting more expensive as regulations don't go away. They just keep adding on and adding on and adding on. So trying to manage all that and manage cost and make the thing put a smile on your face, it's not easy. You know?
Speaking of mom and dad, Haitian immigrants.
Yeah.
When you take mom to black tie functions, you know, et cetera, or you're being honored, and you look in her eyes, what do you see?
Extreme pride. I think my parents and my family in general, very proud of. I represent not just Ralphie, you know, having made it, as she calls me. It's the fact that a Haitian immigrant's kid could be there, right? So they talk about it all the time. And even in Haiti, there's discussions about me there, and they talk about me almost in a folkloric way as this kid who made it all the way to, you know. I don't think about it as I go through my day. I just feel like I'm a regular an American Canadian kid who's doing his thing. But I get reminded that my beginnings and my end could have been very different had they stayed in Haiti and challenges come about. So this was a bit of an alignment of the moons in a way, the stars and the moons. But I never take it for granted, and my mother never takes it for granted either.
Speaking of the, you know, stars and moons being aligned, you lead a team of 300 designers. Mm-hmm. Each one is an artist.
Yes.
Believing that my design is the best. You've got four main studios in Brazil, Auburn Hills, Turin, Italy, and China. What's it like herding cats with these 300 artists.
Jack, your analogy is perfect. It's exactly that. It is. You got to let them run a little bit, let them run wild, and you have to tolerate that wild running at the beginning of every project and let them express themselves, right? But what I tend to do is explain the problem to them. And most industrial designers are a little different from a fine artist, where industrial designer knows there's a thing that has to be made in mass production, usually in mass processes. So once they understand the case fully, I try to educate them on the business realities, the customer, what we can do, a platform that may exist or not. And soon they take their own cold shower. I usually don't have to do it for them. You know, they kind of come to the realization very quickly. And I'm always impressed by how quickly they realize they have to really get going. So some of that happens on its own. The rest is me clearing the brush. On the other hand, when they're pushing an idea, and if I really believe it with them in it, I have to clear the brush for them and really fight for it and make sure we get the extra spending or the risk that it may incur. You know.
If we ever need a new chief of the UN, United Nations, you run a United Nations.
And I love it. I really do. That's the thing most people don't realize is how international our companies in general have become, but ours, I see it every day. And the fact that our brands, when I travel to Italy for work reasons, I see Jeeps everywhere. It's part of the fabric in Europe now. And most of them were designed, all of them were designed here in Detroit. So it's kind of neat to see how the influence. But the reason we can design vehicles for the world is because we have people from all over the world. So it really does help us be more relevant in other markets.
Ralph, what's the difference between the art and the science of designing an automobile?
These pesky people called engineers in the middle. There's all kinds of engineers. We're outnumbered 10 to 1. There's probably 10 engineers for every designer, if not more. So yeah, they're quickly descend on our projects and manufacturing engineers, there's dynamicists, metallurgists, plastic engineers, you name it. There's an engineer for everything. But we're friends with them. We love our engineers. We pet them. We take them out to lunch. We do everything we can to keep them on our side.
A few years ago, we had Ed Welborn.
Yes.
You know, the GM iconic
good
designer.
Good friend of mine now, actually.
Right?
Now that we can actually talk.
Good. Hope for the kid. I quote him now, "The absolute best vehicles happen when there's great collaboration between the designer and the engineer."
Yes.
How do you get that collaboration?
So my little thing is I call it campaigning the vision. So I spend a little more time to help them see what we're trying to do. So I bring them in very early in the process, and I show them those doodles we talked about earlier and help describe the possible. And you should see their eyes light up. Once you kind of get them away from the computers and the slide rule, so to speak, they start to understand what we're trying to accomplish. And they love being included because they never experienced that in school. They never really did that process. So once they get what the mission is, so to speak, then it's amazing. They will strap on whatever they got to do and go get it. And they love the challenge. So I think it's campaigning the vision and sometimes intoxicating them with the vision. Really get them to fall in love with what you're trying to do, and then they'll make it happen.
Ralph Giel, what has designing cars for 27 years taught you about people?
People are fickle. people also sometimes don't know what they don't know yet. They can't always describe what they like, because there's vehicles take time to grow on people, but we can't always shoot for what we see today. As a designer, I try to be a little bit ahead of if you're too far ahead, you lose. Like the airflow back in the day was too ahead of its time. If you're too complacent, you become a commodity. So trying to find that perfect balance where people are at first cock their head sideways and go, "Huh, what is that thing?" And then pretty soon they go, "I like it." And then all of a sudden it catches on. So got to anticipate what humans like, but you really got to make sure you check the functional boxes. If anything I've learned about, especially mass producing, doing cars in volume, you've got to give them intellectual alibi to buy the car.
Speaking of anticipating what Americans like, talk to us about America's love affair with pickups. We sold 2.8 million of them in 2018.
It's amazing. And that's because I think, you know, Americans are doers. They're do-it-yourselfers. They love it. Again, a lot of America is rural. I mean, people don't realize America is not just Manhattan, Detroit, L.A. You know, it's got a lot of country in between. And a pickup truck just works. It's safe in some ways. It's very weatherproof in a way. And if you're building your own shed or whatever, you can't beat it. And Americans like lending a hand. I mean, I have a pickup truck myself, and I made so many friends because of it. Hey, can you pick this up for me? Can I borrow your truck? Can you tow this? So it's a great social device as well as a fantastic machine. And they're no longer the penalty boxes they used to be. They used to really be workhorses. Today, they're practically luxury cars that just happen to have a bed in the back. You know, so it's pretty
a little
neat.
More than a month ago at the Detroit Auto Show, that Ram 1500 was named 2019 Motor Trend Truck of the Year. When they announced that, what was your first thought?
I was literally emotional because that award is special because it's called the NACTOY Award. So journalists from all over the planet vote on it. It's not just a local thing here. It's a really significant award. And for them to recognize our truck for all the effort, and we put a lot of effort. The new Ram has so much love and sweat equity in it. I love the interior. Ngoti did a great job in the interior. The exterior is really finely tuned. But the whole thing as a system is thought out. And I go back to Mr. Marchionne, daring us to be number one in the segment. What do you need to be number one? And he gave us everything we asked for, and Mr. Manley continued that. And it's fantastic that just about everything we asked for, we got. And now it's on the public to discover how good the truck is. So I'm really proud of it. And for the journalists to recognize that is a great start. Yeah.
Speaking of Mr. Manley, mm-hmm. Michael Manley.
My new boss, yes.
is the current CEO of Fiat Chrysler. Tell us about Michael Manley.
It's a great man. He's been with us since 2001. He's a great pass. He used to be a dealer in Europe. He knows the business inside and out. He's dealt with the Chinese side of our business for years. He carried Jeep from where it was in 2009 to where it is today. So he's done great things for the company, and he's an incredibly intelligent man, and I like working for him, so I'm looking forward to some great times.
We're talking to Ralph Giel, and I'm Jack Crisula. And this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Crisula. This is Anything Is Possible. And we're talking to Ralph Giel, who since 2015 has been the head of design for Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, Ram, specialty vehicles, as well as Fiat, Alfa Romeo, Maserati, and as such leads a team of 300 artists worldwide. Ralph, these 300 people, what model years are they currently working on?
We're about 2.5 to 4 years out, and in some cases as much as even 5.5 years out. Hmm. Yeah.
Let's talk to us about the next generation of technology in designing cars.
Wow. We're using about everything. Most of our equipment is very similar to what the movie industry uses. A lot of three-dimensional tools where we can create a car virtually. That we put our ocular glasses on and I can review a vehicle or I can spin it around and almost feel like I'm inside the actual vehicle 2 years before it's even produced. So it's really exciting to have these tools at our disposal.
Electrification. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about electric cars.
They're coming. They're coming. It's going to take a little while just because the technology curve is still very expensive to do, and gas is cheap, and there's not a natural pull for it yet. But the electric packaging is interesting as a designer, where the batteries go and the engine disappears, and the batteries typically go under the floor, which is going to change proportions of vehicles and make them maybe a little taller, make the wheelbases longer so you can fit all that stuff. But at the same time, they're going to be very interesting vehicles to drive and obviously very good for the planet and stuff like that. But the key right now is getting to be affordable. We can make a $100,000 electric car very easily, but doing that same vehicle at one-third, one-quarter of the price is not so easy.
Autonomous vehicles.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think my view on that is they're coming. I mean, that's another technology. It's not as aggressive as what the electric car is doing. They're not related either. People tend to relate them together. But a lot of the interesting technology that's coming in the hunt to autonomous cars is being used today for what we call ADAS, Advanced Driver Assistance Systems, or Advanced Safety Systems, however you want to describe it. That we're seeing already in our new minivan, our new Ram has much of those ADAS features, the radar, the sensors, high-fidelity sensors and cameras that will make cars safer and almost brake for you and warn you and wake you up when you're drowsy. So much of that technology is gonna get into cars really quickly, and then the full autonomy is probably going to be more commercial applications in cities and congested areas at the beginning, and then, like anything else, gradually over time, it'll trickle down to the average person.
It's 2030.
Mm-hmm.
Paint for us a picture of driving and mobility in 2030.
I hope by 2030 that accidents are almost unheard of. That's number one. Cars would almost be impossible to crash, just like the plane system today. The FAA does a great job of keeping planes out of each other's way. That is what V2V car communication is all about. So that technology is around the corner and being experimented with real time. That's number one. Cars will be as safe as can be, even without using the airbags, if you know what I'm saying. And this car sharing, I think, is something that's building up a lot of momentum as kids, you know, are more comfortable with sharing things. That's going to change how people buy. And then the globalization, the world is still evolving. There's third world markets that are becoming second world and first worlds overnight. So there's still some growth in the industry. I think it's going to be a mixture of things by 2030. But definitely it won't look like what it looks like today, that's for sure.
At the same time, the average car today is 11 and a half years old.
Yes.
What happens to all those cars?
They get recycled and they move on. I mean, there is a replacement rate. It's about right around 12, 14 years. So there's plenty of purchase cycles left in the classic automobile. And every time someone buys a new car, it's more efficient, it's safer. So that's why you see oil demand going down. There's as many cars as ever, but they're so efficient. They're getting more efficient. So it's helping curb demand for fossil fuels just naturally. You know.
Have you ever gotten a letter from a 15-year-old kid?
Yes. As young as 10, as recently, I had an 8-year-old come visit me. We actually showed him our Heritage Center. So yes, I get those little Ralphies, so to speak, contact me. So I try to respond. I do actually respond to everyone I get.
How can a young person get into designing cars today?
Well, you know, that's a very small career. So yes, you got to figure it out. But I would say to kids out there in general, it's never too early to start planning your future. You're a kid for a while. Yes, you want to have fun, but you got to come up for air out of the video games and all that stuff and think about what you want to do for a living. I didn't have Google back in the day. I didn't have search engines to be able to reverse engineer all these different careers. But today a kid can do that. So I would say take a little bit of time once in a while and start investigating what it would take. And if you start early, if you start planning your future when you're 10, 11, 12 years old, you'd be surprised how easily it falls into place. And all of a sudden you're 22 years old and you're doing your career. So that little bit of time that you invest in your formative years, I can be a bigger kid now that I'm, you know, close to 50. I'm having more fun now than I ever did when I was 15. So it goes back to the keep your eye on the prize thing. My parents used to say.
Success is a journey.
Yeah.
And the good you did this morning, they've already forgotten about by noon. Where do you keep drawing your inspiration from, Ralphie?
My people. My own staff. I'm fascinated. As you know, I hire new people every year. So there comes some fresh minds and fresh attitudes. And keeping my existing staff fresh. And so I love that family atmosphere we have at FCA. We try to really nurture that and do things socially together. So I get inspired because I'm lucky to have a job where I'm surrounded by creative people. And with that comes an incredibly great aura. Yeah.
The instrument panel, the navigation system, the gauges. It's almost like a theater. What's it going to be in 10 years?
It's going to be, hopefully, they put a little chip in your brain and you just kind of imagine stuff. I don't know. We are spending a lot of time. Screens are here to stay, I think. We're looking at very advanced heads-up displays. The beautiful thing is the processing power of a car is starting to be very interesting. You know, we've gone from pretty average stuff today to, in the very near term, like our Uconnect systems are getting 4, 5, 6 times faster than the old stuff. So the things you can do in a car are limitless. But it shouldn't look like the inside of an airplane of an aircraft. It has to be simpler to use. And
speaking of what we can do is limitless,
mm-hmm.
Ralph Giel, the greatest architect and artist of all time, bar none, was God. When you look around at nature and everything, his creation, what impresses you the most?
Besides the woman, I'm fascinated by subaquatic life. I really, you know what I mean by fish, right? Because they're aerodynamic devices that go underwater. Water, you know, the way fish are shaped, and you go deeper in the ocean to get more radical, wilder looking. They're still finding creatures every day that they haven't seen before as you go deeper into the ocean, or we have vessels that can go deeper. So it's fascinating, all the incredible themes that God had, you know. So just when you think you run out of ideas, a designer's worst nightmares wake up in the morning and go, that was my last idea. And then you look at how nature still fascinates you with its creativity is very, very inspiring.
A few minutes ago, you talked about globalization.
Mm-hmm.
From your eyes, tell us about globalization.
The world is shrinking. I mean, right now, people, if you look at stars that have social media followings in the millions, their followers are from all over the world. So people are cross-exposed to cultures now. So I think cultures will start to approximate each other more and more and more. And we find that happening already. Western music is enjoyed all over, vice versa. Some of the movies, American movies, do better overseas than they do here sometimes. So there's a fascinating thing going on where the world in some ways is compressing. You know, the generations as they come are becoming more similar. So that I'm watching. I don't know what the solutions are for that, but I do know that it's here to stay.
Speaking of watching, the late, great Art Van Elslander. I once went to Beverly Hills, California with him, and we walked into this The Mirage, a new five-star hotel. And I pride myself on being, you know, color-coordinated, etc. As he described for me, Ralph, what he saw in that concourse blew me away. You have those same eyes. What's been the most impressive room you've ever walked into?
Whoa. In some ways, the Vatican. When I went to, I saw the Vatican, and it was the amount of human effort it took to do that, right? The coordination, the willpower, the vision. Crazy, incredibly complex place, but just that, the sheer ability of man when coordinated what man can do, you know?
That St. Peter's was 125 years, mm-hmm. six generations of families, Ralph. They only worked on one building.
It's crazy. And then, to be honest, also the Sagrada de Villa, I think it's what it's called in Spain, mm-hmm. the beautiful church in Spain that's still not finished, over 100 years as well. So.
Success is a journey, not a destination.
Wow. Absolutely 100% agree with you, Jack. It is ongoing. I kind of erase my hard drive every day and start over in a way because the minute you think you've got it figured out is when you don't, right? So
in business today, every day is a tryout.
That's so true, especially in our business. You know, if you can't keep up, you got to move out of the way. So.
You're less than 50, but in a way, you're like you got the curiosity of a little child. How do I get that?
Wow. I think it goes back to self. Always look at yourself and wonder, can I learn something today? You know, that's what I do. I, again, being surrounded by young people, they do humble you because what they know is different from what you know. And my daughters inspire me every day. They introduce me to new music, new social ideas, new movements. And I just keep an open mind and try to reinvent myself. Yeah.
As our time winds down together this evening, what advice would you give to our young listeners?
Like I said before, it's never too early to start. Second is open your mind. If you can't physically see the world by getting on a plane, and hopefully you can, if you ever, instead of going to the same vacation spot every year, change it up. Really get out there and see, because that's why I've been very lucky to travel all over the globe with Chrysler and Fiat. And what I've seen, it just impresses me how complicated and how beautiful our world is. So just get out there. And search it if you can't fly there and learn about it. It's a wonderful thing.
Ralph Gill, you're a modern-day Horatio Alger story. Thanks for all you do, and please keep up the great work.
Thank you.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohom. Believe in yourself.